Good evening, and welcome to the beginning of a new season of Great Conversations. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's discussion by authors Madeline Springnether and Rafael Iglesias. It's an honor for the College of Continuing Education to produce this series for the University of Minnesota. Since 2002, we've presented nearly 40 unique discussions between prominent members of the university faculty and their distinguished guests from around the world. As you may have noticed in the photographs from previous events, Great Conversations have represented the multidisciplinary research conducted here at the university and have introduced us to some of the leading thinkers of our time. It's nice, too, to see some of our past speakers in the audience tonight, including John Wright and Judith Martin, as well as many University of Minnesota alumni, advocates, staff, and supporters. I'd like to express my appreciation to our media sponsors, Minnesota Public Radio, Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine, and MinnPost, for their loyal support of this series throughout the years. Thank you, and welcome one and all. Tonight's speakers have each used their extraordinary literary talents to explore the conflicting and sometimes crippling emotions surrounding grief and end-of-life issues. Through their moving yet unsentimental work, we as readers truly experience the transformative power of art. Madeline Springnether has been a professor of English at the University of Minnesota since 1971 and currently serves as the department's director of graduate studies. As a writer and literary scholar, her work has changed the way we view two of the central figures of Western culture, William Shakespeare and Sigmund Freud. Besides her research on Shakespeare and Freud, she has published widely and influentially on contemporary female writers and feminist psychoanalytic theory. Professor Springnether was one of the visionary scholars who founded the university's Women's Studies Program and Center for Advanced Feminist Studies. In the mid-1990s, as director of the Creative Writing Program, she spearheaded the movement to upgrade its graduate degree to a full MFA and led the program to the national prominence that it enjoys today. In recognition of her many contributions, she was named a Regents Professor in 2009, the highest honor the university bestows on its faculty. In addition to her scholarly writing, she's the author of two volumes of poetry and two memoirs, including the acclaimed book, Crying at the Movies, a film memoir. Rafael Iglesias is a prominent and prolific author of 9 novels and numerous screenplays. His legendary literary career began with the publication of his first novel when he was just 17 years old. This autobiographical novel, Hyde Fox and All After, was critically acclaimed for its unique and revealing portrait of an adolescent boy seeking to find his place in the world. His next two novels were published in rapid succession by the time he was 21. In the mid-1970s, he began writing screenplays and has since written works for Hollywood films ranging from the supernatural psychological drama Dark Water to the screen adaptation of Victor Hugo's classic Les Miserables. In 1993, he adapted his own novel, Fearless, into a riveting film exploring the traumatic emotional struggle of the survivors of a fatal plane crash. Last year, after a 13-year absence, his novel, A Happy Marriage, was published to wide praise. As one reviewer noted, with unflinching honesty, he reveals the resilience of the human spirit in the face of illness and loss. This revelatory power is shared by both of our speakers this evening. So please join me in welcoming Madeline Springnether and Rafael Iglesias.
Thank you all for coming this evening, and Mary and Margie Ligon for making this event possible and giving me the opportunity to have this conversation with Rafael.
Yes, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
I thought I might begin by telling you all a little bit about how I got to know you. It was about 10 years ago, and I was teaching a course called The Cinematics of Loss, in which I was teaching all films that dealt with loss or mourning or grieving of some kind or another. And the film Fearless was central to that course, as was your novel. which of course preceded the film. You wrote the screenplay for the movie. But I actually had seen the film before reading the novel. And I wanted to teach the novel and the film simultaneously, so I wrote to you to see if I could get some copies of the book, since I was having trouble finding them. And you very graciously replied. And then we got into a more lengthy conversation about the relationship between fiction and film. And the basic reason for my interest in Fearless, which relates actually very closely to my interest in your most recent novel, is that it deals in such a powerful way with death. It's the novel about a man who survives a plane crash and who, as a result, feels invulnerable, which also is an unreal state of mind and puts him out of relation to his ordinary family, his wife and his son and his friends. And there's another survivor of the crash, and I won't go into that story because you can tell us more about that. But the real impact of the film on me when I first saw it was the replay of the plane crash at the end of the movie. And I, as a viewer, wasn't anticipating how this was going to affect me, and I found myself crying completely out of control, and in a way that was deeply embarrassing. It wasn't just, you know, weepy or sentimental. It was kind of convulsive.
Right, yeah.
But it made me kind of come to my senses in a way, because what happened when I was watching this scene of a plane fragmenting is I thought something, first of all, like, this is what it's like to die. Then I thought, this is what it was like for my father to die. And he had drowned when I was 9 years old. He was 42 years old. And this was a very traumatic event in my family life.
And you were there when it happened.
I was, yes. But it was something that my family didn't really respond to, strangely. It's as though this terrible thing happened, but we did not acknowledge it.
Right.
And somehow or another, I failed to acknowledge it. But I found myself having these very powerful emotional responses to movies. And it was that particular film that caused me to reflect on why this was happening. And that led to the memoir that I wrote, Crying at the Movies, which is a meditation on displaced mourning, in effect.
Right.
So I wanted to ask you, first of all, what was the genesis of that novel? Because that's a real interesting story in itself.
I wrote Fearless in the early 1990, but the idea for it came out of something that happened to me when I was only 25. So that would have been about 1980 or so. I was with a friend, and we were, although I knew how to drive, like a lot of people who grew up in New York, I didn't have a driver's license. So my friend was doing all the driving, and I'd never actually been with him in a car. He was a critic, and we had gone out of about 2 hours out of the city to see a play. And we stayed over, and then the next morning we drove back. And it turned out he didn't really know how to handle power steering. He kept going off on the side of the road, and the third time he did it, he jerked the power wheel very hard. And we went across the oncoming lane of traffic. And we were heading directly at a bank of trees, and like any stupid 25-year-old, I didn't have my seatbelt on. So I realized in that sort of elongated time that happens whenever you're in a situation where you think you're about to die or something terrible is going to happen to you, that very elongated moment, I thought, oh, this is it. This is how I'm going to die. And I was actually slightly irritated by the fact that I was going to die this way because it really wasn't my intention to die that way. And I felt that I really had a lot of other things to do. So... and it was a weird feeling also of calmness as I calculated that I was going to go through the windshield when we hit the trees. And instead, what happened was the car wheels hit a ditch, and the car flipped over like a stunt, landed on the roof, and it blew out the windows on all sides. And somehow I was thrown out through the rear window, landed on all fours, and I had a little stigmata from a broken piece of glass in this hand. But I was otherwise unhurt. And my friend, although he had his collarbone broken, wasn't badly hurt either. And for the next really 48 hours, I experienced what the character in the book I wrote about it experiences in a much greater way, which is sometimes called pink cloud syndrome or is sometimes called post-traumatic stress disorder. And what it really is a sense of absolute invulnerability and also a kind of deep pleasure in being alive. Everything tasted great. Everything was wonderful. And I was also utterly unwilling to be hypocritical. I would say whatever occurred to me. So after it wore off, I was very interested in it, in a state of mind, and I began to do a lot of research about it. And I eventually decided, in about 1985 or so, there was a plane crash in Sioux City, Iowa, that perfectly did what happened to me in a much more elongated way. There was a plane that lost its hydraulics, which meant the pilot couldn't steer. And all previous planes that had lost its hydraulics had crashed and everyone had died. In this case, the pilot improvised and he rocked the wings of the plane and managed to bring it in for a crash landing in which half the occupants of the plane died, but half survived. I knew that if I put a character on the plane who was phobic about planes and knew, therefore, all the things that could go wrong with them, that I would have a character who for at least 20 minutes would have the experience I had for just a few seconds. We'd have these 20 minutes, this extended period of time in which he was certain he was about to die. And I knew from other research I'd done that that would mean that his post-traumatic stress disorder would last for a much longer period of time. And I was about to start the novel then when I realized that it was kind of fake to write a novel in which someone survives a plane crash and is happy. So I did some more research and discovered that on almost all plane flights, mothers tend to lose their children because they're instructed to hold their toddlers or infants in their arms. And you can't hang on to a child in that situation. So they're torn out of their arms and they die. I had a 3 or 4 year old son at that point, and I thought it was the worst conceivable thing that could happen to anybody, to lose a child. So that's how I created the other character in Fearless, who's a woman who's lost her child. And the general shape of the novel is that he's fearless and she's catatonically depressed. And a therapist who's in charge of dealing with all the survivors hits on the idea of bringing the two of them together because they're in such extreme states. And they, in effect, bring each other back to a kind of normalcy, which actually is to be afraid, because to be alive is partially to be afraid.
I remember you're saying, I think this was 10 years ago when we first talked, that about your character, Max, in that novel, that first of all, he is phobic about flying. He's excessively afraid of flying. Then he is afraid of nothing.
He's turned inside out, yeah. The idea is that he's very neurotic and very phobic before it happens. And then after it happens, he's the exact opposite. And neither state is normal. The normal state is to be somewhat fearless and to be a little bit scared. And it's that
realistically.
And that's really the journey I take him on. And similarly, I take her, the other main character in the story, on a way of reconnecting to life through a kind of grief that really never leaves you, but can overwhelm you to the point where you can't live at all.
As I remember, Carla, the female character, feels overwhelming guilt at the death of her son.
Right.
And Max helps her resolve that feeling of guilt, helps her to understand it actually was not her fault.
Right. I didn't really begin writing the novel until I hit on the idea of Max, at the end of the story, recreating what happened to her in the crash by crashing his car. So actually the novel comes back to my original inspiration. He has her try to hold on to an object while he crashes the car. He's in the front seat. And she can't, and it flies out of her arms, just to physically illustrate to her something that intellectually she's been told, but that she doesn't really believe, that there's no matter how hard she tries, she couldn't have saved her child. That doesn't make her feel fine, but it alleviates the guilt anyway.
Right. One of the ironies of that novel and the film, the situation the main character is in, for me, was when I first encountered it, that feeling invulnerable leads him to challenge death, which in fact could lead to his death.
Right.
And if he stays on that course, he would die. So I thought that was a very interesting kind of twist, that his conviction that nothing can harm him compels him to put himself into situations where he might actually be very drastically harmed.
Right. I mean, this is actually, the Hurt Locker illustrated this in a different way. There's a kind of adrenaline rush that comes with defying death and feeling you're overcoming it. And he keeps trying to get it back, the way an addict might keep trying to get the drug back, because he's so happy at the feeling of not being afraid.
He made it, yeah.
I think it's Martin Luther King, I may have this wrong, who said that nothing great can be accomplished if you're afraid of death. And there's real truth in that. You know, you do have, to a certain extent, in moments of great crisis, really have to overlook the fact that you might die if you do something that's correct to do.
I want to fast forward now, because the next point of our connection really was through your most recent novel, A Happy Marriage, the title of which might be a little misleading to people who haven't read about it or haven't read the book, because it's an autobiographical novel, and it deals with the death of your wife from bladder cancer. It's a very gripping novel. It's very visceral, I want to say. And one of the things about it that I found so compelling when I first read it is the way that your character, Enrique, as a narrator, doesn't shy away from any of the physical realities of illness and deterioration. And I wondered if you would be willing to read a passage from your novel that I think really illustrates this point, where your wife has reached a point in her treatment where she doesn't want any more treatment. She's been battling cancer for 3 years and nothing has worked. And she decides to discontinue treatment, leaving her a very limited amount of time in which to say...
Right, she has reached a point, her cancer has advanced to the point where her digestive tract has shut down and she can't even stay hydrated on her own. And for, 5 months, she had been staying alive through intravenous hydration and intravenous nutrition, which are very ineffectual ways of keeping someone alive. In fact, she was gradually losing weight and getting weaker and weaker. And what it meant was that she was in a situation where if she simply, because she was at home, I was in charge of the hydration and the nutrition, mm-hmm. and since the book is straightforwardly autobiographical, so is my main character. She knew that if she stopped getting any hydration and nutrition, in about 8 days or so, she would die. And she decided, since death was imminent anyway, that she would control the one thing she had left to her, which was the timing of her death. And she spent about 2 weeks saying goodbye to everyone in her life and then stopped the hydration and nutrition and slowly fell into a coma and then died.
The moment that I wanted, the passage I wanted you to read is just before, there's a last meal that she has with her family. And this
right.
is, since she can't really digest the food, it's for the sake of the family gathering and just the taste of the food. But the food itself has to come out of a stomach tube.
Yes, because her stomach is completely stalled out. Anything she swallows is evacuated by a tube that comes out of her stomach because it can't be processed normally.
Right.
And she has a last meal with her family that gets stuck. It sounds funny, and it is kind of funny, and that's sort of what the scene
yeah.
is about.
Yeah, oh, please.
Sure. She's actually just been asked by her mother, someone who she has a difficult relationship with, why Margaret, who is the name of my wife, is why she never invited her mother to her studio to see her paintings. She's just asked mm-hmm. her that question. Perhaps that's why Margaret on her deathbed looked confused by her mother's question as to why she hadn't been invited to the studio. She thought it had all been settled. The whole family waited in a hush for her to answer. When she did, there was a disarming truth to it. "I'm weird about my paintings, Mom. I don't like to show them to people. It's not you. I just don't like to show them." She moved as if to sit up while saying to Enrique, "It's crazy, but I think my stomach tube is clogged from the hot dogs. They're backing up." She pulled the covers off. Her peg, which is the tube that leaves her stomach, was full of the reddish-brown and beige material of the Second Avenue deli lunch. The Cohens scattered at this frank display. Enrique and Margaret retired to the bathroom, their first time alone, since his conversation with Dorothy and Leonard, those are her parents, rejecting their funeral arrangements. They conducted their last post-mortem of her parents' feelings. Enrique described their reaction while standing at the sink, helping Margaret suction out pieces of undigested food that were too bulky to clear the narrow end of the peg. They were old hands at this. There was a time when the grotesque procedure would have nauseated one or both of them. When it seemed that more hot dog and knish were coming out than had gone in, they began to laugh, and they laughed harder when Margaret said, "It's like every hot dog I've ever eaten is coming out." Enrique suctioned and Margaret squeezed, and he told her that Dorothy had exclaimed in pain when she heard that Margaret didn't want to be buried with her family. "You did a good job, Puff," she judged. "How do you know?" "Because she hasn't said a word to me about it."
Thank you. That's a very powerful passage, and it led me into a particular train of thought that I'm going to pursue with you for a bit. This novel is about death, but it's also about love. And passages like the one you just read caused me to think about how much of loving is physical. And I first recalled something that I knew a long time ago and tended to forget over time, which is that when my daughter was born, so much of my loving her had to do with taking care of her physically.
Right.
You know, just feeding her, bathing her, soothing her, putting her to sleep, all the things you do with an infant is, I think, one of the things that makes you fall in love with your own children. And I think most people understand that, but it's harder to be aware of how much caring for an adult who needs physical care is also an aspect of love and brings you closer to them in the process. It's a part of intimacy. And one, I'll tell just a small personal story here to illustrate what I'm saying. Many years ago, I was visiting my ex-mother-in-law with my daughter.
Right.
And at my daughter's request, but also my ex-mother-in-law had requested it. And we got into kind of a ritual of going to see her every year or so. She was a very wonderful, generous woman who welcomed me back into this enormous extended family, which I had left many years before. But she was also getting older and somewhat disabled, and she needed nursing care. She needed caregivers. And at some point in time, she needed caregivers overnight as well as during the day. And on one of these visits that my daughter and I made to her, her overnight caregiver wasn't available. So we were asked if we would do the things that the caregiver would do, and we said yes. I, of course, didn't know what that meant. You know, it's like, what do we do? Will we do it right? And so on and so forth. So I asked for a lot of very specific instructions, which we received. And then with some trepidation, you know, approached this overnight experience. It went very, very easily. And we did everything she needed us to do. We undressed her completely.
Mm-hmm.
She had a catheter bag that needed to be drained. I needed to measure the urine before, you know, disposing of it in the toilet. She had a leg brace that needed to be removed, and she had to be physically placed in the bed. We had medications to give her. And I was surprised by how simple and easy all of this was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought, surely this is going to be embarrassing for all of us. Not a bit of it. And when it was over, what I thought to myself is, I feel much closer to her now because of this experience. And that's not something I would have known without having had it. And it feels to me like a lot of that is implicit in your novel. It's something that we absorb by reading it. You don't have to say it, but it is there, that part of the way we love people most deeply is how we care for them physically.
Yes, I mean, that's right. Actually, your experience is very similar to what happens when someone first gets ill. You think, I can't do this, they'll be upset, and so on. My novel, as you know, alternates between the first 3 weeks that Enrique and Margaret meet, when they're 21 and 24, and the last 3 weeks of her life. And there are a few chapters in between. But I often contrast, as the chapters move back and forth, between these two young people and their physicality, how horny he is, how beautiful she is, how nervous he is sexually, with the incredible intimacy they have at the end, where there's really no, you know, there are no barriers, there are no secrets, there are no physical. And in a way, a part of the reason I tried to create that contrast is because it's a kind of lovemaking, the physical caretaking, in the same way that there's lovemaking when you're young. Obviously, it's less fun. Obviously, it's gloomier. But part of being human, no matter how brilliant we are, no matter how spiritual we are, is being physical, is our physical natures. And part of how we express love, just as you were saying, in all situations, comes down to how we are physically. It was always important to, and it's actually been important to other people I know who have died, because my parents are both dead, and they both died rather slowly, and my brother also, my half-brother, also died slowly of ALS. And that physical contact all the way through to the end of life is just as important to people as when it's no longer sexual. It really is part of being intimate, because we're physical creatures all the way till the end.
Taking this in a slightly different direction, I know that you had wanted to write a novel about a long marriage for some time before you actually wrote this novel.
Right.
And I wanted to quote back to you something you said, I think in an interview, about what it's very hard to get at, you know, what it is about a long marriage that is satisfying or real, because so much of our culture presents us with very superficial images of romantic love and passion, infatuation, romance. And so I think you've done something in this novel that is quite unusual.
Thank you.
But one of the things that I found in an interview somewhere is a statement you made that goes like this. That's what a long-term relationship is, the making of a new family, a new home for the head and heart. And I thought that was such an interesting way of talking about a long-term love relationship, making a family, a home, a world for yourself, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, when I married fairly young, because I left home fairly young also, so I met Margaret when I was 21, and in my late 40s, I began to want to write a novel about the kind of marriage I'd been in, because it had changed so much, and so much had happened. And because there were periods of time when I thought I was very unhappily married, and periods of time, you know, a great deal changed. But what really changed, finally, was that at a certain point I realized I had lived longer with Margaret than with anyone else, including my parents, that she was, by far, the single most important person I knew. Whether I liked her or not, whether the marriage worked or not.
She was your world.
I mean, leaving all that aside, however I felt about her or how she felt about me, we simply were really our lives together. I mean, one of the interesting things when she got so sick and eventually her cancer recurred was her parents' relationship to her death. Because, of course, like all parents, they felt, in some sense, that they were her primary relationship. But they weren't. You know, Margaret had lived with me for 30 years. I was really her primary relationship. And that had occurred to me before she got sick. And I had thought, you know, I should really write a novel about this from the point of view of a man, because I don't think anyone has really written a novel about, made a story out of a long relationship, with its ups and downs and everything it does. But I knew I couldn't. because the relationship that I knew best was my own. And if I wrote it, actually I couldn't because my marriage was ongoing. And I couldn't really look at my marriage. No, I mean, I knew that it would end my marriage anyway, but I couldn't really look at it. There's no way to really judge it. It's an ongoing experience. It keeps changing day to day. And also, if I were really frank, it would invade her privacy. She would be annoyed. It would cause all kinds of problems. In fact, I wasn't even sure that I would have been capable of doing it myself. That is, that I would be able to write objectively or make myself into a character and her into a character and create a story out of it. So I just dismissed it. And after she died, because I'm not a memoirist and because I don't really write nonfiction, and I dismissed the idea of writing a sort of memoir of her illness or any of those kinds of approaches, I suddenly thought, oh, I can write that novel I wanted to write. Margaret's gone. I can write a story about what it was like to be in a 30-year relationship, and I can be as brutal toward myself as I like because it's not going to have a consequence for her. And I started writing it quite convinced that it was a good subject for me. But then the overwhelming emotional force of what I was doing stopped me three times. Mm-hmm. I gave it up completely. In fact, I was quite sure the last time that I would never return to it. Mm. What surprised me was the passages in the novel that described us young and falling in love were even more painful than the passages describing her death. Because remembering us as young and in love, remembering even opportunities I threw away to enjoy that, just became intensely painful. It wasn't so hard to write honestly about it. That I didn't mind. But the reliving, because since it's novel and I wasn't recalling things, I was trying to make them as vivid for the reader as possible, it became vivid to me, and that became really painful.
What kept you going on? I want to come back to this later about how you came to the writing of this novel, what stopped you, but also what kept you going forward.
I couldn't really write anything else. I wrote 100 pages of another novel and couldn't stay interested in it. I worked on some film things and I wasn't really interested in them. I also wasn't making any progress in any other area of my life. I said to somebody that I was a caretaker for a museum that no one came to visit. I kept the apartment sort of the same. You know, and I was very young. Margaret was 3 years older than I. She died when she was 53. I was 50 when she died. So I was young to be feeling that way, although now several years had passed. And finally, my therapist said to me, I don't know whether you should write the novel as a novel, but it's clearly, you know, you've been a novelist your entire life. This is how you process experience. And you're stuck. The appropriate process of grieving is to recover the self. It's not really to get over the loss of the other person. It's to recover the person you were with them. You have also lost that person. And the
so
normal
lost,
process
you've
of grieving...
You've lost yourself, in
yes,
a sense.
The normal process of grieving is people recover that over time. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't. So he said, so no matter how painful it is, go back to doing what you're doing, because it sounds as though what your novel is it's a recreation of your life together. So do it. And I started, and it was really painful. It was really bad. It was about the most painful thing I've ever done. It took hours would go by, and I'd write a sentence and stop. Mm-hmm. And I'd do almost anything to avoid it. After about 3 weeks of working on it relentlessly, getting very little done, I began to relive the whole marriage. And after a while, it became sort of comforting. It became very emotional and very upsetting, but it was also, because it was such an intense, dramatic recreation.
What part of it would you say was comforting?
It was comforting to revisit my whole life. And that's really what I realized, is that I met her when I was 21, and she died when I was 50, and the marriage, not just Margaret, but our experience together represented my entire adult life. And I, in going over the emotional movement of it back and forth, it was as though I were rehearing, like a favorite piece of music, everything about my life in a way that was so straightforward, you know, so honest, that it was somehow comforting, because it didn't have any of the qualities of being careful about it or being mm-hmm. polite about it. It was just what happened. Mm-hmm. And by the time it was done, I was just as though I were burying her. I was sorry to let it go. It was, now the marriage is over. Now that part of my life is over, and it's done. It mm-hmm. wasn't. It wasn't really a grieving process. It was a kind of reliving process, and mm-hmm. that helped me say goodbye to it. It didn't actually get me over my grief, though. That's the odd thing about it. It wasn't cathartic.
That was a very complicated statement.
Yeah.
I'm going to hold that for a minute.
Okay.
And I want to ask you to read another passage from your novel, if you don't mind.
Sure, the other yeah.
Yeah, this is going back to the subject of how one describes what it is about a long-term, loving, intimate relationship
right.
that is different from the Hollywood images of love, which are, you know, I think pretty...
Well, they're actually writing about romance, about infatuation, which is...
Perhaps. I mean, it doesn't take you too far, though. Anyway, this passage I'd like you to read, because I think it takes the reader into that experience.
Right. Yes, this comes from one of the chapters, not at the beginning or the end of their relationship. It comes in when the author is in his 40s, and pretty much everything in his life that he thought was important to him has proven not to be nearly as important to him as his wife. And what's just happened is that his father has just died, and his father he thought of as the most dominant relationship in his life. Mm-hmm. And his father's just, they're getting ready for the funeral, and he has broken down and begun to sob with his wife. And he's been accusing her that she doesn't love him. He doesn't even know why he's accusing her of this. He's just insisting to her that she doesn't. She held him, declaring, "I love you so much." She leaned back in his arms to look him in the eyes and confront him. "How could you not know I love you?" He sagged onto the couch under the wall of windows. She sat beside him, caressing his hand, kissing his cheek, trying to soothe him while he trembled like a leaf in the wind. For a moment he was still. Then he shivered again and moaned. "Shh," she said. He put his head on her chest and shut his eyes and tried not to listen to himself whimpering. The shaking stopped. When his brain also stopped its frantic noise, its wild attempt to crash out of his skull and flee into the sky, he thought, where did that come from? Once he was quiet, Margaret lifted his head, kissed him on the lips, and asked softly, "You know I love you, right, Enrique? You know I love you more than ever." She looked at him only inches away with the Pacific Ocean of her eyes, washing him clean of the craziness. "You know that, right?" "No," he said, just as a fact. "Well, how could you not know that?" Wonder filled her voice. Her lips parted in astonishment. "I'm crazy," he said. "Your husband is crazy. It's okay to be sad about your father." He grabbed her, and it came right out, although he'd never formed the thought before. "I'm scared you'll stop loving me. I'm so scared you won't love me anymore." "I'm never going to stop loving you," she said, as easily as if she were ordering a meal. "You're my life," she said simply. He squeezed her small frame as hard as he could. She grunted at the pressure and mumbled, "Unless you break my back, then I'll stop loving you." But he didn't relax the tension in his arms, and she didn't squirm or complain again. He wished he could push her inside himself and incorporate her spirit. He felt relief, a long sigh of gratitude, that the race had been run, that for all his mistakes, for all his failures, for all the wear and tear he had doled out, for all that he had smashed and given away of love and good intentions and grand ambitions, for all his errors, there had been an unexpected mercy, and he had not been punished. Life had given him Margaret to make him whole.
Thank you. To make him whole, that's a very powerful statement. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, I guess it's sort of a psychological cliche that as you know from Freud, that people marry, they tend to marry, to repair the relationships that didn't work for them when they were young, when they were children. But I don't mean it in that simple a mechanistic way. When my character, and it was true for me as well, meets Margaret at 21, he's not really grown up. He's not really a formed person. And like a lot of young marriages, neither really is she. And they sort of complete their growing up together. In some ways that's good, in some ways that's bad. I don't really, as consistent with my title, A Happy Marriage, it's not meant to be a model, it's simply meant to be an explanation of what happened. And what he's realizing there is that all of the things that have gone wrong in his life, she ultimately makes whole for him. She really has finished them for him. There is each day of how he lives makes sense to him because they have lived together and made this life together. Even if it's disappointing, even if it's infuriating, even if it's ecstatic, she is really what makes it whole, what makes it something that you can accept and live with in a sort of an even keel. Partly it's there because it's located in the novel where it is, because I'm trying to make it finally clear to the reader what it means to him that he's losing her. He's not simply losing somebody he thinks is sexy or somebody mm-hmm. he thinks is funny. He's really losing a part of himself, a part of herself too, which is the odder part of death, I think, which is that the person who's dying is also losing themselves.
Losing everything,
yeah. I mean, Margaret once said to me, I'm going to miss you all so much. Which is a funny thought for someone who's dying.
Yeah. But it makes sense.
But correct. It makes perfect sense. It makes perfect emotional sense, yeah.
Coming back to this question of the writing process and what it accomplished or did not accomplish for you, on the one hand, you said that you had a great deal of difficulty coming to it, but there was nothing else you could do. You had to do this in order to move to something else. This other novel wasn't taking shape,
I just wasn't interested in it.
So this was the book you had to write. And at the same time, you said something very interesting a moment ago about it didn't resolve your grief. So
no. It is really a cathartic experience because I wasn't trying in the novel to reconcile the reader or anyone to her death. Mm-hmm. The story ends really with their coming together as a young couple and her dying. It mm-hmm. goes back and forth between the two, as a friend of mine said, the two great mysteries of life, love and death. Mm-hmm. It isn't a looking backward and it isn't about grief. It's about loss and the process of dying, mm-hmm. but it's not actually about grief. And so it didn't take me through that part of the process. What it did was it allowed me to be myself again. I was able, since she really comprised so much of a part of my adult life, by recreating her and me in it, I was, as a drama, I was able to then sort of relax and be myself. But I was still very much grieving for quite a while. Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm kind of pushing you on this or probing is that I'm thinking about what writing Crying at the Movies did for me. It was a book I had to write.
Because you hadn't grieved at all.
No, not at all. Right. Our family just didn't get there. And I didn't even know what I was missing. So I had to do that very belatedly.
Also, the death that you experienced was a traumatic death, a sudden death. There was no preparation for it of any kind, which is
right.
very different, I think, for people.
Right. And it also felt to me as though the part of my life that preceded my dad's death was sealed off from the rest of my life. It was like there was this absolute break, and I couldn't put the two pieces together. So for me, the writing of that book was an acknowledgement of my not having grieved as a child, having to do it as an adult, but it also did help me to put the two pieces of my world back together.
Right.
And that kind of allowed me to let go of that, of the deep past. Your loss is more recent, and it's a different experience. And at the same time, however, you in this book have recreated the world that you lived in with your wife, and there's some satisfaction in that. Can you say more about what the satisfaction is?
Well, I have to admit that it's in some ways it's a writer's satisfaction. I really felt that it was a difficult thing to achieve in, as a story, to try to communicate to people the experience of being in a long relationship, not for everybody, but for me, to communicate what it is to live such a long time. I mean, there's a passage in, there's a couple of chapters in the book in which the hero, and this was true for me as well, falls in love with another woman and wants to leave her. He's 28 or 29 when that mm-hmm. happens, it's long before she dies. There's tremendous swings in what the marriage means to him and what it doesn't. And that movement, which was always a puzzle to me, and was more of a puzzle once she died, because all I was left with was the relic of it, is how it became so important to me. And by reliving it as a drama, I understood it. I see, in fact, right from the beginning when we met, there were certain qualities that she had, which I instinctively knew I would need my whole life, and that would help me in life. And similarly, I could see that I had certain qualities that completed her in a certain way. And that although we had a lot of things that didn't work between us, although there were a lot of things that pulled us apart, in the end those things were stronger, and that's why the relationship survived. And sort of by reliving it intellectually and emotionally and physically, which is what the novel forced me to do, I was able to in a way understand the marriage, not as a sentence, not like in a Dr. Phil sort of way, but I mean to understand it in a full experience. And so that was a very satisfying thing to feel, mm-hmm. okay, now this huge hunk of my life, which was in some ways a mystery to me, is not a mystery anymore. I see why it was so important. I see why it lasted. Mm-hmm. It wasn't laziness or you know, it was really, there was something very profound between us that we both needed. And that, as a shorthand, we call a relationship or love. So the solving of that mystery was very important to me. But it doesn't relate to loss, losing her, which is another question.
Well, the loss goes on.
I mean, you
on.
Had a mystery. The loss of your father is also a mystery for you in a different way. And I think that you explored that through the movies. And so it becomes, I think you solved that mystery as well as to why what it did to you. And so that may be why you felt afterwards that you could move on. I think there's a similar quality to it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, there are obvious differences, but I think there is a point of convergence, and it maybe does have something to do with the artistic function that creates a world of some kind. For you, you were recovering the self you had lost and creating an image of the marriage you had once had. It didn't make the marriage come back. It wouldn't bring your wife back. But it's still not a total loss. Maybe that's a poor way to say it.
It's an odd thing having written the novel, because I'm proud of the novel and I'm very glad I wrote it, but I'm always, always aware that it came at an enormous cost to a lot of people I love, not only my wife, but my children and her parents and mm-hmm. her friends. It's an odd sort of achievement. I mean, I'm glad about it, but I'm not. Mm-hmm. I joke when sometimes people ask me what do I think my wife would think of the novel. What always occurs to me first is she'd be glad because she'd be alive. There's, you know, no matter what
I'm here,
you know, and so that part of it is odd too. It's odd to have written something I'm proud of that I'm really not happy exists. It's an odd irony.
Right. I want to move to one other thing before we run out of time here.
Sure.
And that is, what about the impact of this book on other people? Because we've been talking about how you felt about writing it, or what writing can do, perhaps, for the writer who is grieving or dealing with a major loss. But what about your readers? And there was something you said, I want to quote to you from an interview that really interested me, about and this goes back to the beginning of our conversation about how detailed you are in your description of your wife's illness. And I found that that drew me in. That made it real to me. And one of the things you commented on about this is, the graphic nature of your description of cancer and how it ravages the body. So this is your comment about that. If I softened or obscured the details of the typical deterioration of cancer, then my novel would become discouraging to readers who had lost people to the disease. I thought that was a really interesting statement. It's like they wouldn't find themselves in the book. They would feel more alone rather than less so. More than anything, I feel what fiction does is relieve us of the solitude of our experience.
Right. I mean, I think the only conceivable argument you can make for novels being useful is that they, unlike, theater is cathartic and movies are visceral, but a novel can bring you into the consciousness of another human being. You can know what it is to live in a different time or a different culture. Or if the novelist is willing to really be detailed and not sentimental and not be dishonest about the nature of being alive, then you can really enter into it. The readers who seem to find my novel useful are the ones who have either been in long relationships and lost mm-hmm. them or are thinking of going into long relationships. It's an interesting group of young readers who really like the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, someone theorized that they think, oh, they finally know what their parents are about. But I don't want to sound priggish or self-righteous about it, but if you knowingly write something in which you make a difficult situation, or any situation, even marriage, seem much easier or more graceful than it actually is, I think that does the opposite of what fiction can do well. It pushes the reader away. The reader thinks, well, I wasn't like that. Oh, I didn't think that. And mm-hmm. and they feel increasingly alone. They may admire you and think, wow, he's a spectacular person, mm-hmm. and I'm not. But that isn't really my goal as a writer. My goal as a writer is to be as completely direct and as full as I can be in communicating the experience of another person, and that let people come in and absorb it. And then when they're done, they can step back and say, I didn't like that, I thought that was right, I thought that was wrong, mm-hmm. I thought he was good, I thought he was bad. Their judgments can return to them, and they can become themselves. But while they're reading the book, if I succeed, and I think if any novelist succeeds, you break down that difference between the two of you. And for a while, and I think this is true for all of us when we read a book we love, you sort of cease to be in a way that you don't normally. Your consciousness merges with another. Mm-hmm. And until you close the book and walk away from it, you're in another person's life. And if I wrote about the daily handling of someone who's dying from cancer and made it nicer than it is, then not only the people who know I'm lying, but I think even people who don't know I'm lying would suspect I was, would think, well, it can't be that easy, it can't be that nice. So although I'm not brutal about it, and I don't make it, I don't try to make it difficult for the reader. I try to make it as clean and as simple as possible. This is what happens, this is what has to be done.
Well, the effect it had on me is that it felt close to lived reality, mm-hmm. even though the experience you describe is not mine. I could find parts of myself in it, and it felt honest. I guess part of what you're saying is readers don't want to be lied to about the reality of their own experience.
Some do. Some readers do want to be lied to.
Well,
but
that's
not
escapism. I mean, that's a
most.
Different function. Yeah. You know, no. if you yeah. want I mean, to escape from your reality, there are many ways you can
right.
do that.
Yes, I mean, I think if your goal is to entertain people and divert them, then you should be really entertaining and really diverting, and not get close to something serious. But if you're going to write about something serious and real, then do it properly. Don't turn it into an entertainment. I don't think there's anything wrong with being pleasant, but I just if I think it's bad to add to the loneliness of the world, to say to people, this is not, you know...
Let's not do that.
Let's not do that. I mean, why do it? Why do it? And there's also, cancer also happens to be a fairly common experience.
Yes.
And almost everyone, when they reach, by the
you,
time they
if
reach...
If you don't have it yourself, you'll know somebody who does. You'll
yeah,
be
once
close
you get to
the
RH, I mean, you're going to deal with people who have cancer. So it seemed to me an odd thing not to write, you know, directly and simply about. Mm-hmm.
Have you heard from readers who had this experience or been close to people who died of cancer?
Yeah, I have. I'm very surprised by some of the people who read the book and really liked it, people who are sick with cancer. I'm very surprised by that, because she loses the battle, as it were, so that surprises mm-hmm. me. But certainly people who've lost people, that it always surprises me how much it does seem to do for them what it didn't do for me. It seems to allow them to grieve and let go. And also I have heard from people who've been in long marriages who are relieved to read a story in which the marriage is not perfect. The marriage doesn't have one single crisis that change, you know, in which mm-hmm. it's a texture of an entire life lived together. And even though they're often very different, their life experience is very different, they recognize that sort of internal rhythm that exists between people who stay together.
Right. I like the way you're talking about the usefulness, the use value of fiction or literature or art. And I know that our title is The Transformative Power of Art, which seems to be making very great claims. I'm more comfortable really talking about how people use artistic experience, whether it's literary or musical or otherwise. And it seems to me that part of what it does is what you've said, relieve one's sense of solitude. It's, oh, yes, I recognize that. I'm not so weird after all. Something in my experience finds resonance outside myself. Also, you can...
But it also does what your memoir writes about. It also provides catharsis. It can allow people to experience emotions that they have buried in their real life, and that or that overwhelm them in their real life. And it can
bring you to yourself.
It can allow you
to
blow off that emotion in a way that's safe and allow you to look at things in yourself.
There is actually a wonderful quotation, which I'm going to read from Kafka about this, and it's one that is, you know, fairly familiar. I've come across it many times, but every time I do come across it, it strikes me anew as saying something that feels real to me. And what he says, this is in a letter to a friend, is, "What we need are books that hit us like a painful misfortune, like the death of someone we love better than ourselves, like suicide. A book must be an ice axe to break the frozen sea within us." That's a bit extreme. Nevertheless.
It was really comic.
That's Kafka for you. But I think what he's trying to get at, or the way I take this, is it's so easy to live one's life in surfacey ways, and to forget what really matters. To one can get so busy in ordinary activities, mundane kinds of things, that you lose your sense of what really matters or what your deep feelings are. You don't have time for them. There's no time or space in the day to recall yourself to yourself. But I think that artistic experience, when it is powerful, gets through all that. It just cuts straight through.
Yes, all the arts, I think, when someone loves a work of art, it's a kind of emotional intimacy that is very rarely achieved in life. I mean, that's, after all, the goal of art most of the time, is to communicate a feeling in a very profound, on a profound level, on an almost nonverbal level, which is what makes writing so hard. There's a kind of value in that, I think. I like to believe there's a kind of value in it, especially especially about emotions that people are not comfortable talking to most people about. It allows them to feel it in a way that is safe, and therefore they can then organize their own thoughts about it.
something facetious comes to my mind. I'm sorry.
What?
Well, you don't want to sort of go around saying to people, let's talk about cancer, shall we?
Right.
You
know? Right. Exactly.
On the other hand, if it's a part of your life or your experience, you want some place where you can acknowledge that. And if the place is in a book, that's useful.
Right.
Or if it's in a conversation with a very close friend, that's also useful.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they're both useful. But there are certain emotions I'm not sure, and I think that's part of your memoir, that you're not, that people aren't sure they have until they experience them in a way that's safe for them. I think that was the case for you in going to the movies.
Shall we invite our guests to join us?
That'd be fun.
This has been such a deeply honest and really affirming conversation that you've shared with us tonight. I just want to give the audience a chance to join me in thanking you for this conversation.
Thank you.
And we love to ask questions, so here comes a really fun part of this evening, too. To Raphael, a question for you first. Can you talk about the process of translating a novel into a film?
Sure. The simplest thing, the most important thing you have to do when you adapt a novel into a movie is decide what you're going to cut out, because almost every novel is simply too long for films are 2 hours, and if you adapt most novels literally, you'll be in at least 3 hours, and in some cases, 16 hours. So, I adapted Les Miserables, and that's a 1,600-page novel. It's, it would literally be 16, 20 hours or so. So the first thing you have to decide is what you can cut out. And you usually make that decision by trying to identify what the book's theme is. And then you cut away anything that doesn't directly speak to it. Unfortunately, in the American movie-making system, most movies are built around a star or two stars. So if you're adapting a novel that has multiple characters, you usually have to decide to focus it on just a couple of them. And then there are other issues that if a novel is psychological and if there are certain turning points that are internal and don't have a visual or act or some sort of action to express them, you'll have to spend a pretty good long time figuring out how to make it into a drama, how to make it something explicit for the audience. And that can often be bad. I mean, it's easy for that to slip into something terrible. But those are the main things you have to do. And after that, when you begin writing the script, you have to now try to take the story that you have adapted off of the original text and start to feel that that story is your story and sort of connect to it that way. And eventually, I forget which adapter said this, eventually you learn to, in a kind of friendly way, hate the original book.
In a nice way.
In a nice way. I adapted one of my own novels, and I grew to pretty much dislike the book by the time I got to the book. And one of the strangest meetings I ever had in Hollywood was I was adapting a different book of mine, one that didn't get made, and in the meeting, the studio executives kept reading the book to me as to why it was better than my script, and I had to remind them that I had written the book. So it wasn't that I didn't know how to write that well. But anyway.
There's a related question that would be a follow-up here. That is, what changes have you observed in the film business in the years that you've been writing screenplays?
Oh, the movie business has changed tremendously just in the last few years. Most of the money for making what used to be called mid-range dramas, 30 to 40 or $50 million movies, movies that, as they say in the movie business, grown-ups like to see, has disappeared. I'm not sure that that's clear to the public quite yet, because there's a lag in the release of films. But most of the movies that you see toward the end of the year, what are called the Academy releases, the serious dramas and so on, the financing for them has essentially disappeared, and they are probably not going to be made in very great numbers. In the byproduct of that is that what most of the studios make, 90% of their of what they're making are sequels and big action movies and so on, things that they believe they can give people a reason to leave their homes and go see, Avatar being the obvious example of that. And for me as a writer, since I'm largely a writer of dramas, that makes the movie business extremely boring. And it will probably over time, you will see most of the movies we grow up with done as television series, longer television series, and so on. And so that will change them because they won't be trying to fit into that two-hour box and other elements. They'll be less visual, they'll be more character-driven. Some of that may be good, some of that may be bad, but the business is changing very fast. And my guess is that it will end up being a business of big spectacles like Avatar. But that's mostly what you'll see, and you won't see other kinds of films, smaller films.
There's some curiosity about titles here. So let me ask the first question. It actually says to Mimi, there are some friends of yours in the audience, I think. Mimi, what Crying at the Movies is a great title for your book, this question asks. How'd you decide on that title, and did you know just how good that title was at the time?
How did I decide on the title, and what was the second part?
How did you decide on that title, and did you know just how good that title was at the time?
Did I know? How did I decide on it? I'm not really sure, to be honest. I often have many different titles for a project or a book that I'm working on as I'm working on it. And I seem to need to have a working title, and it kind of inches its way toward a final, something that I settle on. So I don't know when that title emerged. I probably had many other really clunky titles before it. I think if I can recall, I was talking to some friends about one of the chapters, and I think the phrase slipped out, Crying at the Movies, and somebody said, that's it, you know, that's your title. And then I thought, oh yeah, that sort of makes sense, that's good. I had a much harder time with the subtitle. I had very long, elaborate, awful subtitles, and it took me a long time to get it down to a film memoir. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it evolved, let's put it that way. And I think somebody else kind of pointed it out to me.
Raphael, someone's asked the same question about yours. Had you considered other titles for your book? And what were they, and how did you make the decision on what you chose?
I did consider other titles because everyone would ask me, oh, is that an ironic title? Is a happy marriage? No, I very much wanted to call it A Happy Marriage because I didn't want to say, that's what I think the book is. I think it's a description of a happy marriage, which if you think about it, is two people who are together who think they're happy. You may not think they're happy. And indeed, I don't. One of the things I noticed when I was suddenly single at 50 is that almost nobody believes that two people who are married make sense. They almost always say, I don't know why he's married her. I don't know why she's married him. I don't understand why they're together. And partly that was why I wanted to call it A Happy Marriage. I wanted people to understand it neither as being ironic nor as being sincere, that a happy marriage is just that. It is an entity unto itself that may or may not make sense to the outside world.
But did you have that title from the beginning?
Yes, yeah, I did. Because it was something I always wanted to write. I wanted to penetrate this sort of mystery. Mm-hmm. Why do people stay together over a long period of time unless they're happy every single minute, which I didn't was not anyone I knew. So.
Right.
Well, here's another wonderful related question. Since your books, this is for Raphael, since your books are so autobiographical, why do you write novels rather than memoirs? And what do you think of memoirs?
Of my 9 novels, 3 are straightforwardly autobiographical. The rest use things I know about in life and so on. It's really because I'm a storyteller. And to me, although you could write a story and call it a memoir if you wanted, that would be fine. But I think of memoirs as being an act of remembrance, of looking backward. And that, to me, is a different literary style, different literary convention. So the difference for me would simply be how I would approach the work every single day. I didn't walk into my office when I wrote this book and say to myself, what do I remember of that day? And what should I put in? What should I put out? Instead, I began a scene that I might know happened or partially happened. And if something that happened 5 years later made more sense to me to happen there, I just put it there. I didn't worry even for a second whether I was being literal in my facts. I simply wrote it as I would write a story, any other story that I had based on, say, research or someone else. And I treated myself as a character just as brutally as I would have treated someone who I was researching. To me, that's not what memoir is supposed to be. Memoir is really supposed to be a personal reflection, not necessarily a factual one, but really what someone remembers in the way that they remember it. And that's a different kind of storytelling. But I know that for readers, that's a distinction that suffers from, I think they call it, I never studied philosophy, but I think in philosophy they call it the problem of vagueness. I think for readers, a memoir is all fact, and an autobiographical novel has things in it that aren't fact. And if you think of the problem of vagueness in philosophy is usually described as, if you add a grain of sand to 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 a grain of sand, at some point we'll all agree that it's a pile. But which grain of sand converts it from grains of sand to a pile is vague. It might be 1,125. It might be five. You know, it's vague. And I think for readers who think of memoirs as all fact and autobiographical novels as grains of sand that have been added to it that are not fact, it seems vague to readers what the difference is. But for me as a writer, it doesn't have anything to do with facts. I can imagine a memoir that isn't particularly factual, because if a person's memory is not factual, then neither is the memoir. And I can imagine novels that are very close to fact. It's really more about what the effect the writer is trying to achieve. It's kind of inside baseball stuff, but to me it's an important distinction.
You used the word research. Question is, how much research do you typically do before writing a novel or a screenplay?
A tremendous amount, because I'm a realistic writer, so I really like the details to be accurate. Even for my own story, I did certain pieces of research. I made sure that I had the medical terms absolutely correct. That's one of the ways it's not a memoir. I describe things in detail that I didn't actually remember, but that I knew would happen. Because when it's happening to the character, he knows it. So I had to give him a better sense of it than I recall. But that was part of the reason why I wrote this as an autobiographical novel. I couldn't imagine how I could research someone else's marriage. I didn't imagine that I could be as intimate about someone else's marriage as I could be about my own. So, except for very close autobiographical stories, I do a lot of research. In the case of Fearless, I researched it for 3 or 4 years. And the novel I published before this one, which is narrated by a psychiatrist in the first person, I asked what the reading, anyone who trained as a psychiatrist would have to read. And I read it for several years and studied the discipline as though I were a psychiatrist, because I felt I needed to have the voice correct.
You are certainly both teachers. We have some questions about teachers and students here. And let me start with one from Madeline. How do you balance the shift between academic writing and your personal projects?
I don't. I fail. I try. I try to balance. And I'm always flipping one way or the other. I wish I had a better answer to this question. I'm one of those people who is unbalanced. let me try again. I'll be more hopeful here. I when I'm writing, I really don't want distractions. I can't tolerate distractions. I need a lot of space and time to focus my thoughts, because my mind is flipping all over the place. So when I'm busy with teaching and academic work and social life and out in the world, which is what that is all about, it's hard for me to attain that focus. I need a lot of solitude. And I think there are writers who do better than I do at maintaining this kind of balance between your life in the community and your life with your interior processes, whatever they might be. So I just try to reserve big chunks of time when I can to do writing, because that's the only way I can do it.
With the many leadership roles you play in the department and your college, it must be extremely difficult, especially. Raphael, question about teachers. Which teacher or teachers taught you the most about the craft of writing novels?
Oh, I cheated in that respect. Both of my parents were novelists.
Ah.
They were both born into very poor families. And it took them a long time. They had a long struggle before they had the time and the leisure to write. Not the leisure, the time, really, to write. My father wrote his first novel in the evenings on the weekends while holding down a full-time job. And he published his first book when he was 43, and my mother published her first novel when she was 56. I was a late child for them. My mother was 39 when she had me, and my father was 35. So as they were becoming writers, I was growing up. In fact, when I was 6 and 7, I had what I thought was a regular, healthy American family. My father went to work every day. My mother took care of the kids. And then by the time I was 9 or 10, they went nuts. He quit his job. He started publishing books. My mother started working as an editor. Then she began publishing books. So I grew up with the delusion that anyone could become a writer anytime they liked.
And, why not?
And also, although I didn't know it, all of their conversations, because they were two people who were very driven to become writers and had to struggle very hard, all of their talk around the dinner table was about writing. If I came home and said, oh, my friend Barry, da, 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 and they'd go, oh, that's like the scene in Tom Sawyer where he gets him to paint the fence. So I was taught sort of by osmosis. And in a way that was good, in a way that was bad, because any time I've changed something about what my parents believed about writing, for me it's a much bigger deal than for most writers, because I'm now defying my parents. But that's really how. They really taught me, and the rest of what I learned came from reading writers they told me to read.
There's a question here for you, Raphael. How did you come up, goes back to the title questions we had. How did you come up with the names in A Happy Marriage? What role did they play in The Grains of Sand, changing from memoir to fiction that you just mentioned?
My first autobiographical novel, I copied something my father did in a novel that he wrote that was autobiographical. I used the same last name that he used for his autobiographical character. I used it in my first novel. So I returned to it in this novel. I used the same doppelganger name for my family. And I made the obvious sort of changes for other people in the book. But when I was writing my wife's character, although I changed her family's last name, while I was writing the book, I kept her name Margaret as it was in real life. And I did that partly because she had been dead for 3 years. She was the only person in the story, other than my father, who was no longer living. And since I was writing very specific dramatic scenes in which everyone was alive, I was worried that if I didn't call her by her name, if I didn't have the same nicknames in the book and so on, that it wouldn't be as vivid and as real. So while writing the book, I kept her name, her first name, as it is. And I decided that when it was done, I would change it. But when I finished, I thought, well, why am I changing it? I mean, I'm not going to pretend to people that it isn't a portrait of our marriage, so why change it? I wrote it that way, leave her first name as it is. And also, in some senses, I wanted to honor her, because, as I say, it was a book that came at a strangely high cost to me. So, but I used, since I've written one or two other autobiographical novels, I used the same kind of names I used for them.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Final question for both of you that we have time for here. That is for other writers. What advice would you give writers who are starting out today, who are here because they're aspiring or going to be inspired as a result of hearing this? What advice?
Tell them how you became a writer.
Tell them how I became a writer.
Yeah.
You mean my school experience and all of that?
Sure.
I... I became a writer in not a way that I would recommend. I wrote a novel. I wrote a very straightforward autobiographical novel when I was 15, and I dropped out of high school to finish it because, unlike Madeline,
who had too much schooling,
I couldn't do two things at once. And when it got published, although there were other things I could have done, I stayed home and I worked and I wrote. I don't actually recommend that because writing is a very solitary kind of work. And I think that being alone at that age is not such a good thing. I also didn't understand the point of education, which I think is very valuable for a writer, which is that the point of education is to, in a relaxed way, in a way that isn't, you're not being judged by the world, not a serious world, you're being judged by teachers, which is not the same thing. You get to experiment. You get to learn about a whole variety of things, of where your talents are, where they aren't. And as a writer, that will always be valuable to people. Gertrude Stein said it's not her ambition to know everything, but actually if you know everything, it would be helpful as a writer. And so the young writers I know now, I tell them really to get degrees and stay in college as much as possible, but not necessarily to focus only on studying writing, that it's really their chance to learn about a wide variety of things. But in the end, I have to admit, and may just be a function of my experience, I think it's impossible to learn about writing in any other way, finally, than by writing. It is a muscle. It takes a lot of practice. You have to develop a voice. It's a physical process as much as anything else. And although you need to read a lot and although you need to know a lot, in the end you have to write a lot for it to be good.
I agree, write a lot. I don't think I have any better advice to offer than do it. Do it sooner rather than later, do it a lot, and have confidence in yourself. I think what undermined me the most in my long coming to writing was a feeling that I wasn't good enough. And that was coming from me, it wasn't coming from the rest of the world. I put that on myself. So if you have the desire, you think you've got something to say, go ahead, just do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we are all grateful that you have come to writing, both of you. This has been really a remarkable conversation, and again, I want to thank you all. I'd like to also invite the audience to continue this fascinating conversation in the lobby at a dessert reception where there are books by both Raphael and Madeline, and they're available for sale and signing by these authors. Thank you so much for a truly fascinating evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
So great, thank you.